SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, in association with SNI Surgical Neurology International, are pleased to present another in the SNI Digital series on controversies in spine surgery with Nancy Epstein, who is the presenter. It'll be a 75-minute lecture in four parts with interactive discussion. Nancy Epstein is a professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York and at Stony Brook, and is the editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International. Nancy has been in the practice of spine surgery for over 40 years and has one of the largest bibliographies of papers in the literature on all aspects of spine surgery and neurologic disease in the world. This lecture, and divided in parts, will be on posterior surgical approaches for neurologic diseases involving the cervical spine. Part one is on the anatomy, imaging, and clinical presentation of posterior surgical approaches for neurologic diseases involving the cervical spine. We are back for another outstanding lecture from Nancy Epstein, and this is on a subject that she's talked about previously, and it's in the videos that you have on SNI Digital, but this is more detail and more background on posterior cervical surgery. Now, you may find, if you go back and look at her videos, that she's done anterior approaches, complicated anterior approaches, some posterior approaches. At least we're just talking about the cervical spine. She just did one on the Cauda Equina syndrome, thoracic discs, and a whole bunch of other subjects. You'll see them on the menu of SNI Digital. But this talk, and she's obviously completing a series of these, plans to have a series of talks basically on all of spine surgery. And this one is on a challenging topic. It's on better patient selection and performance of posterior cervical surgery. And you know, she's clinical professor of neurological surgery at the School of Medicine at Stony Brook, editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International, been in practice for 40 years and probably has more publications than most, or if not all, people who are working on spine. But one thing you know is Nancy's gone through the literature. We're getting facts. We're getting facts so we can make reasonable decisions. This is not related to any manufacturer. Nobody sponsors this. We're not promoting anything. You need to be able to have the facts so you can make the decision yourself. So, and Nancy, did I summarize that right?
I think that's great. Yes, thanks, Jim. That's perfect.
Okay. So I think, why don't you go ahead and we'll go from here.
Okay. I mean, the whole purpose of, creating these lectures is to help people really sort of start rethinking about the procedures they're going to do. The mistakes happen when you choose the wrong operation or the wrong patient. So we're going to be backtracking and going through this on a very elemental level. We're going to look at cervical anatomy briefly. We're going to go over MR and CT studies, because I can't emphasize enough how critical it is that every surgeon knows how to read their own diagnostic studies. You can't just rely on radiology. You then have to be able to do your own neurological exams. Does the patient have radiculopathy or myelopathy? Choosing to do a laminectomy, and typically you'll do many of these laminectomies with posterior fusions, is very important, because if you don't listen to anything else in the lecture today, it's to emphasize, if you have the option to do a posterior cervical approach, a cervical laminectomy as opposed to an anterior cervical discectomy and fusion or anterior corpectomy, your posterior operations are going to have much less morbidity and mortality. This is a classic image of a patient who's prone in a 3-pin head holder. Again, you want the 3-pin head holder. You want the eyes free. You don't want pressure on the eyes. You don't want a patient to wake up blind. You want to keep their neck as neutral as possible. the bony anatomy. Anteriorly, you have the seven vertebral bodies. Obviously, you have the ring, the arch of C1 and C2 to 7. Posteriorly, you have the spinous processes and lamina. And if you're teaching medical students, I always say, you know, ask them to put their arms in front of them. Tell them that their body is the vertebral body. The spinal cord is in front of them. From the elbows to the wrist, that's the lamina, and their hands are the spinous processes. And if they're going to do a laminectomy, all they have to do is bend their arms up and they've freed the spinal cord.
Can I ask you a question here? Why don't you finish what you're saying that I was going to
ask.
We'll go back to the previous slide, because for some of the people watching the previous slide, there's someone that's showing the person prone.
Right.
You mentioned they are not going to get injury to their eyes. And I'm sure you're talking about a horseshoe head holder.
Horseshoe head holders. Also, if you know, if they're putting plastic over the eyes, those can be very dangerous and compressive. Obviously, intraoperative hypotension can also lead to cortical blindness. But the most important thing is use the three-pin head holder. It takes minutes to place. You know, you have to put a staple or two maybe when you're taking it off, but you can stop worrying about any direct pressure to the eyes if you use that three-pin head holder. A lot of our orthopedic colleagues won't do that, but this is really is important to use whether you're neuro or ortho to protect the patient.
Let's say I'm in a country and I've got a horseshoe head holder. I may be wrong, but that's all I've got. What do you do to secure the head?
Well, then you're probably going to use some tape at the same
you gotta
time.
Tape them in.
You can use tape. And actually here you can see the tape that's on the shoulders.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not really going to spend much time talking about intraoperative monitoring, but very, very carefully, don't over tape the shoulders down because you can cause a brachial plexus injury by doing that. And that's why if you have access to it, you want your somatosensory evoked responses along with everything else to make sure you're not getting a traction injury to the plexus as you're positioning patients in this position.
Okay, we can go on. I just wanted to make that one point. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we went over some of the anterior and posterior anatomy. This is just to reinforce. Anteriorly, you have the anterior vertebral bodies. You've got the anterior longitudinal ligament, the posterior longitudinal ligament going actually from the occiput down to the sacrum. You're going to want to remember that for the sake of this lecture. Centrally, you obviously have the spinal cord, and posteriorly, the lamina and the spinous processes. Just in terms of reminder, the spinal epidural space is circumferential. So anteriorly, you have the vertebral body. Then comes your epidural space. You've got blood vessels, you've got fat. Those are the predominant things. And obviously, you've got the posterior longitudinal ligament sitting right in front and ventral to the anteroepidural space. Then you're going to have the dura. The dura is going to hold your spinal cord and the nerve roots, and the CSF is going to be subarachnoid, et cetera. But here again, your epidural space goes circumferentially. And then posteriorly, you've got the lamina and the spinous processes. So always keep track of anatomically where you are, what you're doing, and what the structures are that you may end up injuring. Here you have a coronal view of the vertebral bodies sitting one on top of the next, vertebral arteries coming out of the transverse foramina. And here on an axial image, your vertebral body, your spinal cord, then you've got the lamina on both sides, hemilamina, whatever you want to call it. Then you have the spinous processes back here. This is your spinal cord and the space here, your facet joints on either side. Okay. And then again, your vertebral arteries, again, in your transverse neural foramina. I can't emphasize enough, you know, if you have a patient, looks like a cervical disc, if it looks a little aberrant, get that MRA to make sure that you don't have a vertebral that is actually impinging on the subarachnoid space and the spinal cord. And, you know, you don't want to go take out a disc that's not going to be a disc, but rather the vertebral. Anatomically speaking, let's just look at this again. The anterior cord is the motor. Motor evoked responses are going to monitor the anterior cord largely. Posteriorly, you've got somatosensory, you've got the posterior column, so somatosensory evoked potential. And then you've got your roots on both sides. Take away all the bone. Motor evoked potentials are going to monitor the anterior cord. Somatosensory evoked potentials, the posterior cord. And then you're going to have your EMGs are going to monitor the anterior motor root and then the posterior sensory route. So if you have access to somatosensory evoked potentials, intraoperative monitoring of any kind, I would say please use it. And don't forget, don't paralyze the patient, because otherwise you're not going to have anything to monitor. CAT scans, MRI scans. I use this actually very much to teach the residents as well as the patients. I say, have you ever eaten M&M? In the United States, almost everybody has. And the chocolate is the soft stuff in the middle, and the hard candy shell is what's called a calcium. So if you're forgetting the difference between an MR, soft center, chocolate, CAT scan is the perimeter. A very good teaching tool for those who might not be as sophisticated. The normal canal diameter. This is the normal canal you're measuring from the mid-vertebral line you're going to see on the lateral to the posterior interlaminar line. That's where those spinous processes come together, or the lamina come together and form the base of the spinous process. And here is your lateral radiograph image, essentially. You've got the normal canal is 17 millimeters. 13 millimeters is called relative stenosis. In other words, you've developed that over time, or arthritic changes. Let's say you start with a relatively small house, but you put in a lot of extra furniture, versus congenital stenosis. That's when you've been born basically with a very, very small house and you have very little room, if any, to put anything into.
Would you just go back to that one slide a minute? Because
yeah.
You're going to come to it later. I think it's a great view for people to see the difference between a transpedicular screw and the lateral mascu, and how
right.
close it is to the vertebral artery.
Yes. And in other words, this, you know, obviously it's C1 very much so, but here your lateral mass screw is going to go in this way and your transpedicular screw is going to essentially go this way and this way. And watch out for any of those foramina transverse area, can be very, very tricky. Also the ponticulus posticus, where the actually the vertebral exits over, coming over the arch of C1. These are not without morbidity and mortality. So you have to study your preoperative studies on these patients very carefully, but that's definitely a point worth making. Here, again, a figurative diagram of measuring all the different levels. Here is the lateral 6-foot film. Again, I've said in multiple lectures, my uncle was a neuroradiologist and he would test me on this at the age of 15 in his conferences. Of course, we did not have MRI scans back then. But very importantly, you're looking at an MRI scan. You're actually not looking at bone. And that's why I'm going to bring up a CAT scan. Anything that is bone is hypo-intense. You're not going to get a really great accurate measurement on that sagittal view of the MR. But look what you see shortly on the CAT scan I'm going to show you. But here's your canal on an axial study, vertebral body. Look at the definition you have on the MR of your cord. Around it, you have your bath of spinal fluid. You may be also integrating with that some of the fat in the epidural space that may have the same signal. But this is the kind of detail you're going to get with your MRI scan. Now, you're going to look at the CAT scan instead. And again, you're going to get on the X-ray, you can measure. But here in the CAT scan, you can directly measure off your computer based on the actual bone, the actual front to back, whatever dimension it is you're looking for. The CAT scan is going to be much, much more accurate when you're doing this. So if you're doing instrumentation, it really behooves you to obtain the CAT scan to have those direct measurements and have absolutely all the information you really need. Neurological exams. Everybody should examine your patients from the neck down. I don't care if they come in with the diagnosis of low back pain. Examine them from the top down. Sometimes patients may have cervical myelopathy, and then they're walking funny is what they're saying. And they feel like their legs are heavy. Well, the problem may be cervical stenosis. 10% of those patients with lumbar stenosis are going to have cervical disease. And you're going to want to look, you know, C5 root, deltoid. If they put their arm out to the side, can you push the arm down? C6 root, really look at the wrist. And ask, actually, the patient can use one hand to examine the other and push that hand down. Does that come down easily? Thumb and index, can you pull your finger through that? Thumb and pinky, now we're getting to the C7 nerve distribution. These are the kinds of things actually on a telemedicine exam that you can get better and better at And if you're doing telemedicine, see if you can have a surrogate also present, you know, some other person in the room who can help you examine that patient as well. But you can get some very, very valuable information very quickly. Myelopathy, cord compression. Obviously, this is an anatomical specimen, a disc herniation compressing the cord. And here on a myelogram CAT scan, you have iohexol dye in the subarachnoid space. You can see the cord is compressed, and that's a direct extension from the disc herniation anteriorly. Okay, so you're looking at these images very carefully, and you want to know, do they have motor weakness? The motor weakness with myelopathy, it might be an entire arm or part of the arm, the top, the bottom, proximal, distal. Same thing in the lower extremities. Might be bilateral upper extremities or bilateral lower extremities. Reflexes should be hyperactive. A patient who has thyroid disease or diabetes, they might not be hyperactive at all. Hoffman signs in the hands, you may see that. Babinski's in the lower extremities. And obviously sensory loss that may be very, very variable. Loss of urinary and bowel function, that tends to be very late with most cases of myelopathy. But these are all of the things that you're going to look for, and you're going to try and screen your patients. Do not just rely on other surrogates evaluating your patient. You want to know yourself, what criteria do they meet? What disease do they seem to have? Because you're going to have to try and figure out if you're going to design an operation, is it going to really do anything for that patient? Is it appropriate? Is it the right problem? Does that patient have MS? Do they have ALS? Do they have some other disease entirely? So I wanted to make it clear how we choose to do posterior operations in patients. And here you can see again the classic three-pin head holder. We've marked where the incision is going to be, tape on the shoulders, again with somatosensory evoked potentials going, so you're not over-retracting. Obviously, big shoulders, you're going to have trouble seeing down at the lower cervical thoracic junction in patients like this. And this is just a summary I wrote, you know, a few years back. Anterior cervical surgery. This is just an anterior discectomy infusion. It's a review article. Swallowing difficulty, 9%, almost 10% dysphagia. Lots of studies show that that's even up to 20, 30%, at least in the first few weeks and even first few months. Postoperative hematomas. All hematomas are not epidural hematomas. They can be retropharyngeal or wound hematomas. That patient in the recovery room, you're not going to wait to schlep them downstairs to get a CAT scan, et cetera. If they're having respiratory difficulty, you're going to whip them back to the OR or actually open the wound at the bedside in these individuals. Cord injuries, you know, 3%. Recurrent laryngeal nerve palsies. That patient, you know, may wake up and they're hoarse. I mean, I see this all the time where you have a medical legal case. The patient had previous anterior cervical surgery, maybe multiple levels, prior to another operation at another level anteriorly, which is better to choose posteriorly if you can. And then they go in and they operate from the other side and they give the patient a bilateral recurrent palsy and they're respirator dependent and trached. Spinal fluid leak, infections, Horner syndrome, that's injury to the sympathetic chain. Sympathetic chain becomes more exposed as you go more distally. So by the time you get to 5, 6, 6, 7, it can be really hanging out in the breeze. Watch out for your retractors, especially like the Caspar retractors with the big teeth. I would never use those. You've got to be very careful. Use your smooth blades or your very small serrated blades. And here, esophageal perforation that can go along with dysphagia. Rare, but it can definitely occur. I threw this in because I can't resist it. Failure to fuse, an anterior discectomy infusion. You pool together multiple studies. One level, it may fail to fuse about 4% of the time, but look how it climbs up every successive level. Two levels. And how many people just very flip say, oh, I'm doing a two-level ACD or a three-level ACD? The failure rates for these fusions is astronomical. And obviously, mortality. Anterior cervical surgery is going to have trouble. And so some of those major risks are going to be vascular and or neural. But here you have, I've just illustrated for you a major risk with anterior cervical surgery. You've got the anterior longitudinal ligament, you've got the trachea here, the esophagus sitting right here. You're going to be retracting those structures, by the way, and you're going to be using your drill. You don't want a piston into the canal. I've seen cases like that as well. And actually, one was a trial graft that pistoned. Well, it was the surgeon who pistoned the trial graft back into the spinal canal. So these things can occur. And if you go posteriorly, you're going to have many fewer risks. And we're going to go over what those risks can be. And here is a list. So with posterior cervical surgery, what are the risks? It's very rare to get a vascular injury. Now, can you get a vertebral artery injury by going too far into the foramen? Yes. Very unlikely you're going to get a carotid injury because the carotid is going to be anteriorly. You can get jugular vein injuries by going anteriorly. These are, by the way, very underreported, but you're not going to get a jugular vein injury by going posteriorly. Okay? No dysphagia. Well, your only dysphagia may be because of the surgery posteriorly may have taken you a long time, but it's not because of direct esophageal retraction. You're not going to get an esophageal perforation from a posterior procedure. Recurrent laryngeal nerve injury, hoarseness. You're not going to get that with a posterior approach because the recurrent laryngeal nerve is located anteriorly. You're not going to injure the sympathetic chain and get a Horner syndrome because, again, that's an anterior structure. You're not going to get paralysis of the diaphragm or a phrenic nerve injury by posterior surgery, and you're going to have lower risk of spinal fluid leak. So perhaps maybe this is the most important, slide of this entire talk. Think about this before you just say, oh, well, I was trained to do the anterior approach, et cetera. I was speaking to a young surgeon the other day, and he was saying, I'm going to do a two-level ACDF. This is at the lower, C6-7, C7-T1. And I said, well, what about a posterior operation, a laminophoraminotomy, and then a laminectomy, and then boom, you're done, and you don't have all the risks of an anterior operation. And he said, well, I've never done those, the laminophoraminotomies. I said, well, find a surgeon who has, and I pointed out who it would be, and it's a much safer thing to do. So again, posterior cervical surgery, you can address stenosis, discs and spurs, spondylosis, and OPLL, but you have to have a lordosis of some sort. It can be a straightened lordosis, and here I've chosen a diagram to show you that it can be a straightened lordosis. Also, when you fuse, you can actually change the three-pin head holder to put that patient into somewhat slightly more lordosis so that you can fuse them with a lordotic curvature. Here, the patient may just have a normal lordosis, the normal dorsal curvature, and in other cases, it might be a hyperlordosis. And here you can see illustrated, look at all the ventral disease at multiple levels, 4-5, 5-6, 6-7, and look at this as C2, C3, 4-5, 6, and 7. Look at all the posterior pathology, that's ossification of the L ligament, and the lamina can shingle underneath each other as well. But look at the curvature here. So if you choose to do a posterior operation and you take off the bones back here, just like a rubber band, that spinal cord is going to push back into your decompression. So here's just another opportunity to emphasize the pathology that you're dealing with. On this diagram, here you may have ossification of the yellow ligament sitting right back over here. Next, you may see the shingled lamina, again, just like a Venetian blind, where one lamina comes up underneath the other. And that's actually impinging on the cord. And then following down here, you have, you're going to decompress stenosis. So if you take the bone out from back here, your spinal cord can move back like a rubber band into the space that you've created. And then you can fuse the patient to make sure that you maintain that alignment. So here's just an X-ray, AP lateral X-ray. You can just see stenosis. Why do I know it's stenotic? Well, because look, this is the measurement of the front to back dimension of your spinal canal. It is less than the width of your vertebral body. So again, if you don't have any access to a direct measuring tool, et cetera, just look at this. Your spinal canal is going to be less than the front to back measurement of that vertebral body. That's going to be spinal stenosis. And here is your MR seen to your right. This is the washboard. And the washboard means it goes like this and that. And what that means is you have ventral compression from a disc or a spur. You've got dorsolateral compression from the ossified yellow ligament or the shingled lamina, et cetera. And it's going on for multiple levels. This is a straightened lordotic curvature, but this is something still that you can do posteriorly rather than doing something multi-level anteriorly. And here on a CAT scan, here, you've got your X-ray measuring your front to back dimension. You know that you've got stenosis because here that red arrow is shorter than your green arrow. Again, if you're going to remember anything from this lecture, remember this image because you can apply this to any time you're looking at an MR or CAT scan. This is your three-dimensional CAT scan, by the way, over here to the right. And here you can see, look at the spinal canal. It's a mere fraction of the green arrow, and it's seen at all the different levels here. So here is your stenotic canal. This is your CT. I just showed you the MR. Again, you're going to be reading your own diagnostic studies. By all means, speak to your radiologist, your neuroradiologist. They may teach you something, or you may teach them something, and they'll be of greater use to you and vice versa in the future. One of the biggest questions people ask is, well, how do you choose to do a posterior cervical approach? Years ago, a K-line was described. It goes from the mid-aspect of the C2 canal, front to back, mid-aspect of C7, and then you draw a line. If your pathology, your ventral anterior pathology, is in front of that line, you can choose to do an anterior, a posterior, or a 360 approach, okay? On the other hand, if you have what's called a negative K-line, that means that if you draw this line and your pathology from the front crosses that line, like here's classical PLL, then you are really pretty much stuck in many cases doing an operation from the front. Sometimes people will go in and they'll actually put a lordotic graft in at the level above and below to throw the patient into lordosis so that they could switch and do a posterior operation. But this is basically what you're looking for. The positive K line, pathology is anterior to that line. You have an adequate, you could have a straight and normal lordosis or a hyperlordosis. You can have anterior posterior 360 surgery. Again, if you have a negative K line and your pathology goes posterior to that line, reversed lordosis, this is not just straight, but it's going to be reversed. It's likely that you're going to have to do an anterior operation in those cases. Okay. And I'm just going to keep hammering this home. Here's your positive K-line. Here's C2, here's C7. There's your mid-aspect of the canal. And here is your pathology anterior to that line. And you can have disc spurious spondylosis. You could do anterior posterior 360 surgery. But again, if you have the option to do a posterior operation and it has less morbidity, you have fewer adverse events, you have fewer problems, choose the posterior operation. And here is another example, again, figurative diagram, made it very simple, but here is your K-line and your pathology anterior to it and your normal lordosis, again, could be straight, normal, or hyperlordosis. So I'm going to give you multiple examples of this in just a bit. But here's your classic, you know, cervical laminectomy. You know, here's C2, it might be C7 down here. Medial facetectomy for amidotomy at all those levels. If you have a disc or a spur, you can use a downbiting curette in order to try and get rid of those and decompress those. But here is the premise. You've got a good lordosis here. You've done your decompressive laminectomy. Your spinal cord has moved backward into the space that you've created. Okay? Not kyphosis, but good lordosis or adequate lordosis. Here's an MR. Anteriorly, what do we see? Here's C2, C3, C3-4, C4-5, 5-6, et cetera. And there's also dorsolateral shingling here. You can see C2, C3, C4. The lamina of 5 is under 4. The lamina of 6 is under 5. The lamina of 7 is under 6. Hyperlordosis, shingled lamina. You remove these, the spinal cord is going to spring back again, like that rubber band that I've been saying. And that's your MR, but here's a CT showing you direct evidence. And here, C2, C3, C4, 5, 6, and 7, all shingled. You remove those. That will allow your cord to move back into the decompression that you're providing. Just look at this CAT scan. I included it because look at your shingled lamina. Here's C2. Here, look at C3, C4, C5. These can be so shingled and become so calcified, especially in your older patients, and become calcified to the yellow ligament as well, that you know you really need to remove these to decompress the cord in those cases. And here, again, this is a two-dimensional image I'm showing you here. You may have a superior kyphosis and an inferior compensatory lordosis. But again, you remove the bones down here, C2, C3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And again, that cord will straighten out and you'll decompress the cord very nicely. On your axial views of your CAT scan, you may actually see two lamina. So here you have the anterior You know, here's your anterior vertebral body, here's one lamina, and then here's your other lamina. And then this image is going to show you the same thing. So look at your CAT scans, look at them yourself. Look at as many, you know, all the images, just scroll through these to make sure you have a good understanding of how many levels do you have to include. The last thing you want to do is come back the next year. The last thing you want to do is end up with a patient with a deficit because you didn't adequately decompress them. Another example, this happens to be ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament. Why am I saying that? C2, C3, C4. It goes all the way behind the body of C5, going all the way from C4-5 down to C5-6. Okay. And then down the body of 6 to some degree, but maybe focally at 6-7. And there are different forms of OPLL that can do this. You remove the lamina back here, and here's some yellow ligament hypertrophy as well. That cord is going to move back into the dorsal decompression that you've created. Same thing here, you've got multi-level anterior disease, but your posterior decompressions are going to afford that spinal cord the opportunity to move back away from your anterior disease. So always think in terms of what can a posterior operation offer me? You're not going to have to deal with the carotid. You're not going to have to deal with esophageal retraction. You're not going to have to deal with tracheal retraction. You're not going to deal with all those nerves that can get you into trouble. If it can be done more straightforward and more, quote, simply, I'm never going to call this simple, but this is the better way to do it. Again, a normal lordosis here, 2, 3, 4, C5, 6, 6, 7. Now you might have the alternative to go in front, and then secondarily, you might have to go from behind or not. But if you go from behind and that cord can move back away from the anterior disease, you may save that patient an anterior operation. Some of these cases, you might have to do a circumferential procedure. But again, think about the posterior. Think about the posterior first. And here's a patient. This is a patient with DISH. Everything is calcified and ossified. This is a myelogram CAT scan. Not the best quality study, but you can see how you do that posterior decompression, that cord's going to migrate posteriorly.
On case examples and surgical tips for these diseases of the neurologic diseases of the cervical spine using the posterior surgical approaches.
Surgery, well, the one level laminectomy, this is what it looks like. And boy, sometimes you get in there, you're doing a one level, a two level, however many levels. The older the patient, the more ossified or calcified things may be. That yellow ligament is not just going to be that nice, soft, rubbery structure that you've seen in the cadaver lab or imagined, but it can be stuck to everything in sight. So you have to be very careful the way you're going to perform these. Take out your microscope, use your intraoperative monitoring. Again, you're going to do this in the patient with at least some lordosis. Here's your good lordosis shown here. And here, how your cord is going to move back into this, not an operation for that kyphotic patient because that cord is going to stay tethered over the anterior disease. So always keep in mind, you know, are you doing the right operation for the right patient? You're going to remove that posterior lamina. Typically, you'll accompany it with a medial facetectomy for amniotomy. So you take the medial aspect of the facet. There have been lots of biodynamic studies showing you can really preserve pretty much the stability if you do that. If you go in and you knock off the facet completely and say you just want to do a unilateral approach, you're probably better off with a bilateral approach, giving you more visualization. You can deal with a bilateral disease that way and preserve your facet joints. And again, here's the patient prone, three-pin head holder. This happened not to be a three-pin head holder. This was a halo. And because we'd already done a multi-level anterior operation on this patient, now we're doing a posterior fusion with a decompression. Nasotracheal fibroptic intubation, the bigger the problem and the more cord compression you have, the better off you're going to be to do a nasotracheal fibroptic intubation. You're working closely with anesthesia with this, and you're using your intraoperative neural monitoring that starts before you position the patient for surgery. You want to do it before you position the patient. The patient's supine. You give them a bolus of propofol. You can get your motor evoked baseline then, as well as your SEPs, et cetera. This is just an illustration. Again, my father was a neurosurgeon, and this is one of his diagrams, C2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5. You may just have more unilateral rather than bilateral foraminal disease. Okay, here is your extended decompression that you may have. You're doing your laminectomy on the other side to decompress it. By the way, at the end of the lecture today, I just spend one slide discussing laminoplasty. I really don't do laminoplasties. And the problem with laminoplasties, you can decompress one side, but you can't decompress the other. And you can end up with a closed door where nothing's adequately decompressed. So just for the purposes of today's discussion, I'm really not going to cover laminoplasty. You perform your multi-level laminectomy, your medial facetectomy for amniotomy, downbiting curettes. These are the curettes you can get underneath that nerve root and take off some of the bone. You're not going to want to do this with a huge amount of anterior bone. You're not going to want to do this if the patient has severe OPLL because then you're going to injure that nerve root by over-retracting, et cetera. Also, you don't want to go out too foraminally, blindly, and end up taking your vertebral. But here's your decompressive laminectomy. This is what OPLL can look like after you've done a laminectomy. So here you've removed the bone, but that patient had a good enough lordosis that you've actually adequately decompressed the canal. So here, this is a three-dimensional image. You see two down to seven. Here he's, here's three, four, five, six, et cetera. And that's your laminectomy defect that you're seeing on your three-dimensional CT scan. Again, here you have your K-line that showed your disease is anterior to that, a bit of a straightened lordosis. But look in your post-op, the CAT scan is, here you're seeing some air in your wound, but you're not directly seeing the cord. You want to see the cord in your post-op scan, you have to do that MRI. Okay, so here is your pre-op MR. Here is your post-op CT scan. Okay, you can't directly see the cord decompressed. And here is your post-operative MR where you can see the line of spinal fluid posterior to the cord showing that you've got adequate decompression. And here's another example where here you have a patient where there's a very high signal, see two, three, four, five, six, seven, right here. Patient has had a laminectomy and a posterior fusion. Okay, here are the X-rays, your lateral mass and your pedicle screws. C7, you're going to want to put in pedicle screws because it's not good for lateral mass screws, doesn't hold. And then here is your MR, your posterior decompression. Look how I keep talking about it. If this is your rubber band, this is your spinal cord, it's moved back into your decompression. And look at the bath of spinal fluid you have, not only anteriorly, but now posteriorly because that cord is freed. By the way, if you still had more stenosis up above because you didn't study your images, well, that post-op MR is going to show that to you. And I would just encourage people to get a post-op MR before that patient leaves the hospital. It's good to have as a baseline. And it can save you, especially in some cases, if patients migrate posteriorly quickly, they can end up with a C5 palsy occurring within a few days of the operation. You're going to have to do an MR at that point anyway. So you're going to want to use that as a baseline. So here's your typical laminectomy. Here's your medial facetectomy for amniotomy. Here we've done a multi-level laminectomy, and you can see the nerve root. By the way, the nerve root is look like it's coming down. In some instances, if the arms were upward, it looked like the nerve root was going up. But we used to see that when we were doing patients in a seated position. But here you have your arms right down by the side. And this is where you're working in the armpit, really the axilla of the root. You're going to use your Penfield elevator and your suction. You're going to identify that root. Watch out, the motor root anteriorly can look very white and can look like disc. You don't want to mistake it for disc. And you're going to use your SEPs, your motor evoked response, et cetera, to make sure the cord's okay and your EMGs here to try and keep you out of trouble. So here is your decompression being done where the nerve root is now freed. Here's an MR after your C5-6 laminectomy, two, three, four, five, and six. Here, spinal cord is freed, bath of spinal fluid. Okay, and you've done a fusion to maintain that lordosis because otherwise they can slip into a kyphosis, which you don't want to happen. Fusion techniques. This is one of the older fusion techniques. You use wires in the spinous processes, and this happened to be a laminectomy of C3 and 4. Here, wiring in a fusion above and below. This was C2 to C5-6. You put in your rods, and then you can wire it in at the levels above and below and manage to decompress. And here is an example of other screws that are being used. These are your lateral mass screws, C3, 4, 5, and 6. And the pedicle screws, it can be C1 also, but C2, C7, and T1. And you know this, that everything we're throwing in bone autograft as well. But this is the screw entry. You'll look at the Camille or Magurl technique as to how to place your screws for the lateral masses. And here they diagram the lateral mass in four quadrants, and it's just the superior quadrant, very inferior medially on that quadrant, all of these directions, but it's got to match whatever the CAT scan and the anatomy shows for that individual patient. So you're putting in your screws. I can't tell you how many times these screws are going right into the vertebral foramen. So you really have to be very careful. That's why you're going to want to use O-arm monitoring or intraoperative CAT scan monitoring if you have access to it. If you don't, then you have to base it on doing your preoperative CAT scan measurements, and hopefully you have that. What are the injuries that you can get from the lateral mass screws? Nerve root injuries, vertebral artery injuries, those top the list. But look at this other list: malpositioning or loose screws, device breakage, falling apart, malfunction, bone fractures, graft settling and displacement, loss of correction, and obviously pseudarthrosis or failure to fuse. So the list goes on. Complications, vascular injury. I told you that, you know, you're at C1 and there's a screw that's going right into the foramen. Screw right into the foramen. Screw's just missing the foramen. Obviously, if you're doing an intraoperative image here and you've got a screw that looks like it's in the foramen, you've got to be very careful about deciding whether or not you're going to pull that screw out, because you may want to get your angiogram right then and there, because if you pull that screw out, you may have massive bleeding, and you're certainly not going to put a screw in the other side if you have a question about that. So all of these are factors you have to think about when choosing to do, you know, these posterior fusions. And especially if you're fusing to the occiput, lots of times the occipital screws are going to be going right into the cerebellum, unless you're focusing around the inion. Back in 1994, Abumi et al. Came up with pedicle screws, and pedicle screws can be even trickier. This is at C1, where, as Jim pointed out on the image earlier, you have your vertebral arteries here and the transverse foramina. You have to make sure you go medial to those. You don't want to go through the nerve roots on your way to doing that. Again, there are all kinds of explicit entry and degrees, et cetera, that you have to use in terms of placing, you know, any of these screws. And this is just, again, to show you that what the risks can be with these: pedicle breach, vertebral artery, cord injuries, screws loosening, et cetera. So it's something to just think about and keep track of. If you have surgeons in your institutions who've been doing these, grab them. Don't just go to a course and start doing these by yourself. Make sure you have a mentor. And here are your lateral mass screws seen here, and your pedicle screws down below. And here is an actual intraoperative lateral image. Here, C2, here, 3, 4, and 5. Those are your lateral mass screws. And then here down at 7, you may have your pedicle screws. So you're going to use often a combination of these different devices. Again, your O-arms, your CT scan. I just threw in some articles about using spinal navigation, especially at C1-2, CAT scan versus the cone beam CT scan. And both methods can be very effective these days, and markedly increase your accuracy. So use these devices if you have access to them. This happens to be a pediatrics article using the O-arm. Again, much more information, non-contained screws with four patients, but none of these ended up critical and actually injuring the patient. The other advantage, of course, is if you can document with that intraoperative CT that the screws are malpositioned, you can correct it right then and there, rather than bringing the patient back for a second operation. And you avoid the need for the post-op scan. So here, pre-op MR, stenosis, and OPLL. Post-op MR, the cord is decompressed. Here is a laminoplasty. A laminoplasty means that they leave one side attached and they hinge it and then they open up the other side. There are lots of discussion about laminoplasty. One of the main problems is you come down the lateral gutter on one side, but you don't decompress the other side. You're actually hinging the lamina on that side. The lamina can become unhinged and go directly into the cord or the nerve roots. There's a lot, you know, they used to say, well, but this preserves stability. Well, it really doesn't. Most people, I think, would just go for the laminectomy and fusion at this point rather than the laminoplasty. So again, another discussion for another day. Spinal fluid leaks, there's just no comparison. ACDFs, the risk is low. You get to OPLL, the risk is high. I read a study the other day that said a risk of multi-level OPLL was like 58%. So it can get very high. And certainly if you're not using a microscope, it's even higher than that. Look at your preoperative CAT scans. If it has any one of these signs, don't do an anterior operation if you can avoid it. Here's your C sign. I described this years ago where you have anteriorly, you have a chunk of OPLL and it's a little off to the side. You may have the single layer, one big piece, or the double layer sign where actually it looks almost like an Oreo cookie. You see the chocolate and then you see the vanilla and then the chocolate again. It means it's right to and through the dura. A laminectomy, here is OPLL, C2, C3, C4. This is segmental OPLL. This is continuous OPLL. This is your double layer sign that you're seeing on this image of your OPLL. Again, you've got a good lordosis, go posteriorly. So OPLL, but a positive K-line and a good lordosis, laminectomy infusion, it's going to decompress your cord and you're going to avoid that anterior CSF leak and the and you're going to avoid the anterior wound peritoneal shunt, the lumbar peritoneal shunts, the lumbar drains, you know, the positive K-line again. You know, here, C2 down to 7, you've got this OPLL here, but still, look at your lordosis. You've got a good lordosis, despite that CAT scan and the MR findings. These are the same patient, by the way. Look at the CAT scan, shows you the bone. The MR just shows you the continuous hypointense signal. Again, learn to read this, but you go posteriorly, you decompress it, the patient's going to be fine. So in short, and in conclusion, cervical laminectomy infusion with a positive K-line, and either straightening or a normal lordosis or a hyperlordosis, it's going to be safer. You're going to have fewer risks and complications versus anterior cervical surgery. And here you have a cartoon that says, nurse, get on the internet, go to surgery.com, scroll down and click on the Are You Totally Lost icon. And this, people, you know, we all laugh at this. And I can remember years ago, an associate working on a case that happened to be a far lateral lumbar disc. He broke scrub. He this was not his specialty. He broke scrub, ran back to the locker to look it up, and then went back to try and do it again. Thank God the physician assistant on that case had done many of them. But in short, your patients will enjoy better outcomes if you do the right operation. And it's saying, hey, wait, this one's a lawyer. We better wash our hands. I just want to show you some of the articles that you can reference if you want to.
Part 3 are posterior surgical approaches to the neurologic diseases involving the cervical spine. And these are the key references I mentioned. Make sure you're ready to take screenshots of these references for your own records.
This is talking about, you know, posterior surgery, no neurovascular injuries, no reoperations, no residual ventral disease because the cord migrated. So low morbidity. Anterior corpectomies increase the risk of CSF leaks, vascular injuries, and vertebral artery injuries, et cetera. So I'm not just making it up. It's based on what the literature shows. You know, look it up. Look at PubMed. You know, write some papers on this. Alternatively, with an adequate lordosis, posterior procedures may provide adequate multi-level decompression while minimizing the risk of anterior cervical operations. Here's another one, open cervical laminoforaminotomy. We know that this avoids both the fusion as well as the risks of an ACDF, lower incidence of dural tears, infections, and neural injuries. Another one, posterior surgery, relatively safer, lower surgical trauma and incidence of complications. And this is one with OPLL, epidemiology and pathophysiology, and all the clinical features of it. So familiarize yourself with what OPLL looks like on your MRs and CAT scans. This operation actually talked about doing posterior operations, very safe in an outpatient surgery center. Watch out for articles like this, okay? Not so fast. Any patient with any significant morbidity, do those as an inpatient. This can be fast, slick, and especially if the surgeon owns any portion of that posterior of that facility, watch out. Watch out for outpatient surgery, especially in the cervical spine. Circumferential approaches have comparable rear operation, readmission, et cetera, whatever, but they can be high. If you can try the posterior operation first, try it. If there is any residual anterior disease, that can be done secondarily, but you'll make it safer because the cord will have more room. And here, posterior surgery was associated with lower costs and is more cost effective than anterior procedures. The overall incidence of vertebral artery injuries. Notice how low the percentages are that you're given. 0.12, this is 1.1, but remember, the frequency of these injuries is vastly underreported, especially with anterior operations, and it's the lowest with posterior fusions, 0.01%, okay? So I think that that concludes what I have to say about this, and Jim and I will entertain any questions, right?
Part four is an interactive discussion with Dr. Ousman on all aspects of the talk, discussing practical aspects of this, which you can use immediately after this lecture, and there you'll find them very useful.
I have some. We can leave the slides up, I guess. Let me ask you some questions. I think it was a very complete talk. The problem I had is, as you know, as the viewers don't know, is Nancy prepares these. We go ahead and we review them before a number of times before you really see them. So in the end, the more we do, the less questions I ask, and that can be a negative. But here's my question. I'm the neurosurgeon, and I've got the patient who comes in. He's got the symptoms that you have. I can do a CT scan. I've got that. I can see that. I may not have. We've been through this on previous studies, on previous videos. I may not have an MR, but you said before, you can do a myelogram, CT myelogram, which will give you the information you want, correct?
Yes.
So now we're covering all parts of the world. And then
By the way, on that myelogram CAT scan, do the non-contrast CAT scan first of that cervical spine if you have access to the CAT scan. If you're just going to do a myelogram, then you can just do that. But the reason to do a CAT scan or some cervical study, or even just look at that X-ray carefully, you have to be very careful about doing a myelogram in a patient with really super severe cervical cord compression, because sometimes they will deteriorate.
Okay, good
That's
point.
Just a
reason
to think about, yeah.
Okay, so now I'm trying to cover all parts of the world. So there we've got that. If I've got an MR, fine. I can use the MR. I can use a CT.
But the myelogram is good, yeah.
Pardon me?
But the myelogram is useful, yes.
Myelogram's useful, right. So you're not, I'm trying to get to people who hear all these things from their representatives of the companies who want to sell the instruments, and people are writing papers. And in the end, they say, well, if you don't have what I have, or they imply this, you just are not, can't do adequate surgery and it's inferior. And that's just not true.
True. And actually, what's interesting there, Jim, and one of the reasons that I included the slide about putting the wires through the Spanish processes, that costs you almost nothing.
Yeah. So, and the reason is the most important, the most important is between what you, between your ears and
yes.
It's just your brain. So, I mean, you can use that. So I'm here, I'm thinking about it. I've defined the lesion. I've decided, okay, I hadn't read about it much. I know about it. You convinced me to use a K-line. I look at the K-line and I see that the pathology is, from what you're saying, is anterior to the K-line. So I know that I can go from behind. Well, Okay. Now, I know a lot of people don't use the K-line, and I kept asking him all the time, well, why are you doing it this way? Well, that's the way I'm doing it. And at least this gives you an objective measure of
Yes.
what you can do, because I never could get a straight answer to this. I could never get a straight answer to the question of why are you fusing this patient? You're decompressing from behind. What's the reason for? We're going to come to that. And so, okay, I've done that. I bring him to the operating room, and I'm ready to do it. If I have all the facilities there and the monitoring and everything, that's fine. If I don't, we've talked about I don't have a head holder. Okay, what we can do, it's not ideal, because as you press on the neck, you're going to create more of a hyperextension. It's going to distort everything, and it
Yes.
could make it worse. So you put them in there. At least you secured that. You've got the shoulders taped down. You put some kind of recording in for neural monitoring if you have it. If you don't have it, then you got to go without it. But then you got to be very careful about, extremely careful, because you're losing a guide, right?
Yes. And the biggest thing is avoid any hypotension.
Okay,
Make
good.
sure you have an arterial line in.
Now, the other thing, I asked you this when we were working on it. I've got the patient, I put him in the head holder.
Yeah.
Well, if we are doing a patient prone and we're doing posterior fossa surgery, we flex the neck.
Yes.
So you accentuate the midline, you can separate the muscle.
Right.
Well, in the picture you showed, it looked like it was natural position. Is that right?
Well, you try and keep them neutral, especially if they have significant neck pathology, because if you flex them, sometimes you may be tethering their spinal cord over the anterior pathology.
Okay, that's what I wanted you to say. So it's the temptation is it makes it easier surgery, but there is a risk.
That's correct. That's correct. So especially those patients, you have shingled lamina, you'd love to be able to flex them and separate that out and whatever, but the answer is you can't do that because you may incur a deficit in that patient by the time you get to doing the laminectomy.
Okay.
So
So now I've done that, and okay, I'm doing, I'm ready for the surgery. I do the things I should do. We're talking to people who should know how to do a posterior laminectomy by now, and I think you've outlined the details of the procedure. They're down, they've taken the lamina off. You told them that they should, at least they could take a lateral, the medial third of the facet at least, right? I think you said that.
right. But
And
also, Jim, just at that point, they should be using, they're gonna, people are going to be using drills. If you're using a drill,
yeah.
diamond drills, no cutting burrs. A cutting burr can ratchet off. You have to diamond shave it down until maybe you have a tiny little thin rim of bone left over the yellow ligament, and then use your 1 millimeter Karesen punch, but very laterally. You're not going to want to use that Karesen punch medially because you're going to damage the cord.
Okay. The key thing is, again, particularly if you don't have monitoring, very, very, very careful not to do anything that will damage the cord. But obviously, we're talking about a wide range of environment here. Okay, we've done
Right.
that. We've done the pathology. Now I come to a key question. I never got an answer from this question, and that is, okay, I've done my laminectomy. Should I fuse the patient or not? And I can tell you, I've heard everything from everybody gets fused to, well, it doesn't look like I overextended my laminectomy. Why don't we see how he does and follow him in the clinic? If he comes back with symptoms, I can go back and fuse him. What's the right answer?
Well, I think first of all, you get that preoperative MR, and very importantly, you get that preoperative CAT scan. Too often, especially in your older patients, they are getting fusions that they do not need because you could see on their preoperative CAT scans that they're already spontaneously fused. Now, that group is typically forgotten. And actually, in the old days, obviously, my father was a neurosurgeon. And we do a tremendous number of laminectomies without fusions. But the younger the patient, the more the need for the fusion because they are not spontaneously fused. And if they're not fused, oftentimes they will go on to develop progressive kyphosis, And if you have any significant anterior disease, that's going to get worse. And if you have OPLL, the OPLL will progress more rapidly if they are not fused.
Well, okay, let's take the average person, let's say he's 40 years old, he comes in, he's got some arthritis, he was doing exercises or carrying things on his head or whatever it was, and he's got some cervical arthritis, and you do it, you get a nice decompression, everything is anterior, and you can do it, the procedure. Do I fuse that guy or not? And what is it that flips the switch?
More likely than not, that guy's ligaments are not calcified or ossified. His facet joints are mobile and open. And that is a patient you're more likely than not, you've got to fuse that patient.
So would you say if it, would you say 100% if you had a, I shouldn't say that, and highly likely if a patient's younger, you're going to fuse them. If they're older, you probably wouldn't.
That's more or less, yes. I mean, the other thing too is, you know, what we're also talking on the border of, and we're not really discussing is, you know, the group of the laminoforaminotomy group is a different group.
Right, understood.
So let's say you have a two-level laminoforaminotomy, same side. Those are the patients you don't necessarily have to fuse because you've got the contralateral side holding them together. But I would say overall, yes, the younger the patient, the more likely you're going to have to fuse that patient, the older. The oldest group you're not going to have to fuse or not necessarily going to have to fuse, but you've got to look at your studies. I mean, some of them are, you're going to do flexion extension studies. If they're moving, then you have no choice.
So the question though is, I mean, do I have a rule as a surgeon, or what is going to tip my decision to do the fusion or not a fusion? Or if the patient's younger, he gets a fusion automatically, boom, that's it.
You have to do your MR, your CAT scan, and you should do your preoperative flexion extension films. See what the motion is for that patient. But still, a vast majority of the time, that patient having a laminectomy as a younger individual is going to have a fusion.
Okay.
And the older posterior group, you may get away without a fusion, especially if there's no clear-cut subluxation on the films and certainly on the CAT scan if there's evidence of a tremendous amount of stability.
Let's say you choose to just do the decompression. You don't do the fusion. I know most surgeons would do the fusion because I get extra compensation or something for it. I mean, there's another motivation. So let's say I don't do the fusion, but I'm going to follow the patient closely in clinic. It comes every 3 months or 6 months. I get some spine films, and I'm looking for some of the subluxation or something that might happen. Is that
right?
Is that a reasonable choice?
That could be a choice in select cases, especially if you're, let's say you're just doing a medial fascetectomy for amniotomy on one side, and you're not really touching the facets on the contralateral side. The other question I would raise here, and which is very apropos, is let's say a patient, I've seen these patients recently. A patient has an epidural hematoma as a result of an epidural injection.
Yeah.
That patient acutely with a cord injury, you're going to want to do laminectomy, get that patient off the OR table, period.
True.
That is a patient where you could do your decompressive laminectomy, follow the patient afterwards.
So would you?
That's a patient where you don't have to take much off the medial facets, so you may preserve stability.
So now what you're telling me, I'm getting from this mostly, is that most of the time you're going to be fusing the younger patient.
Yes.
That's 20, 30, 40, 50 years old. Starting at age 50 or 60, you may be a little more conservative. Is that right?
More or less, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And is it going to matter? And this now, okay, so now I've made my decision. This is a younger patient. I'm going to fuse them. Now, I don't have one of these fancy machines that's going to tell me which way I eat breakfast and all the other kind of things. I know a lot of older people, I wrote you this, that are able to do this with a high degree of accuracy. That's obviously experience.
Right.
So the question are now in a country, I can't get the x-ray technician to the operating room. That's going to be common.
Yeah.
Okay. There are some guidelines you can use to do this. You do that, you want to check the patient if you can before he leaves the operating room and so forth. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. I mean,
Oh, well,
you
I mean,
can't.
if you have a let's say you're in a location where you do not have access to X-ray. Well, you still, if you're going to do a posterior procedure, then you have to identify C2. And you have to do enough of an exposure to count down from C2 to make sure you're at the correct level. Okay. Number two, you're going to do your decompressive laminectomy as we've described. Number three, if you need to do a fusion, the old procedures that they would just, if you have any stainless steel wire, you can put a stainless steel wire through the base of the spinous process, using a, you put a clamp. Yeah, actually, you can have a drill plus a clamp, but you go through the base of the spinous process, you put the wire through the base of the spinous process, and then you can get various types of rods that can be relatively cheap, and you can place your rods on both sides.
Oh, so now we
So
have.
this is a very cheap way of doing a cervical fusion if this is what you need to do.
What about just putting some bone chips in there and watching them and putting them in a collar?
You can do that as well, but if you have access to some of the wires and the rods, you're going to facilitate that fusion. In other
Okay.
words, let's say you have a patient with a fracture subluxation, you're going to want to try and get a rod and a wire in there rather than just relying on the in situ. The in situ, just putting the bone chips down, that's classical for like used for little children. So
So
in
in other words,
pediatrics, they'll fuse like crazy.
if you really, I mean, if you, again, we're talking about people who don't have all these things and it costs money for the patient, and
Right.
you take off the lamina, you take off the spinous process, you could make bone chips out of that, you could put them in there, and what's the likelihood that patient would get the kind of fusion you're looking for? 60%?
Oh, probably, yeah. I would say probably at least. The other thing too is, remember, you also have access to taking iliac crest autograft, because the bone marrow you're going to get from that is going to be excellent to facilitate your fusion. So forget all this. Don't use your infuse. It's not legal anyway. It's not FDA approved for this use. But don't use your DBM, demineralized bone matrix. You don't need the cadaver products. You don't need all this other stuff coming from the different companies. You use autograft, and you're going to facilitate. You can also use some of the iliac crest cortical bone to be some of your bone graft that you may be wiring into place.
So we've actually, this has been helpful too. If I'm from a place where I don't have these things, I'm now able to do it. I'm able to do a fusion. I can either put some bone chips in there, I can put a rod, that's easy to get, and I can wire it to the spinous processes that are existing.
Right.
And obviously, if you have more, you can do more. You can put the pedicle screws in or the lateral mass screws and so forth and so on. But you're not stuck and handicapped because you don't have the latest fusion to use on your patient.
No, you always have access to these other options. You just
All
have to
right.
think about the options.
Yeah. Okay. That's preoperative thinking. Okay. Terrific. So we
Yeah.
took care of that. I'm going to ask you a question from 50 years ago. I can't remember the fellow who was at the Lay Clinic. He would talk about this.
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah,
Yes.
you not, haven't said this, but it's going to come up, so I want to answer it. That we know the dentate ligaments cause the cord, cause the are
Tether
attached,
the cord,
yeah,
yeah.
and they anchor the cord. And
Right. Forget
some would
them.
advocate cutting the dentate ligaments.
Ignore them completely. Don't even bother. That's been disproven for years.
Okay, so they
That's
hear about that. They answer, no, don't open the dura. That's only going to add complication. And you're not going to, if somebody told you about it, it's not going to make any difference. Don't do it.
absolutely. And then of course you've opened the dura over multiple levels and you've got
Right,
all these other
right.
problems.
So you got a
Oh,
whole set
cool.
of problems. Okay, let me see. I did
Yeah.
that. I wanted to end with one thing. I
Oh,
wrote,
by the way, before we say anything else,
yeah.
if you have a patient prone on a horseshoe or
Yeah.
prone for any of these operations,
Oh.
Your anesthesiologist, every 10, 15, 20 minutes, should be lifting up that head a
Yeah,
tinge, check
right.
the eyes, et cetera, check the face. Otherwise, you may end up with skin from the face sloughing off, much less problems with the eyes. Okay.
Yeah, and eye injury. That's exactly right.
Yes.
One last thing, and
That's
I,
Charlie Fagan you were talking about, I think,
yeah,
right?
Charlie Fagery, and he did a
Yeah.
really good job. And he, but it's before we had all this stuff, and he
Yeah.
was at the time, and when people were beginning to think about anterior, and so he was saying, wait a minute, let's
Yeah.
understand what
Yeah.
we're doing here.
I mean, Joe was the president of the Cervical Spine Research Society in 1981, so I knew all these guys. I
Yeah.
mean, I gave my first paper there, but it was
Yeah.
great.
Now, one thing, just for the people who are watching, is unfortunately, surgeons get in a position where they advocate, well, if I can't do this surgically, I can do that surgically. And I don't think that's, I think that's not the proper reasoning. What you have to do, and you've said that here, basically, you have a disease. And the question is, you've gone through the disease, you found out now, there are multiple ways I can treat this disease. I can treat this disease with treatment A, which turns out to be putting him in a collar and giving him physical therapy. I could do treatment B, which is an epidural. I could do treatment C, which is I could do what you said today. I can know where the K-line is or do a posterior approach and so forth and so on. I could do a posterior approach with or without fusion. I could do a 360 and so forth. The what you have to do is, and you did this, what you have to do is sit down and say, what are the risk benefit ratios? In other words, your goal is to get the highest success and the lowest complications.
Right.
If I look at physical therapy, it's obviously I'm going down the wrong road. That's doing nothing, and that's why the patient's being considered for surgery.
And lots of times it's exacerbating their symptoms
Yeah.
because they'll hyperextend them, et cetera.
So what I'm trying to get the people to understand is that what you do is instead of asking about a procedure, you put them down and label them as A, B, C, or D, or whatever
Right,
it is. And
right.
what you want to do is choose the one logically that has the highest benefit and the lowest risk.
Yeah.
And so you approach the surgical choices after you've come into that the same way. Do I do
Right.
this anteriorly? Do I do it posteriorly? Do I go and do a fusion anterior posteriorly, so forth and so on? And you've got to measure what my outcome is going to be in terms of what's the chance the patient's going to have an excellent outcome versus the risk.
Yeah.
As the risks go up,
Yeah.
then you really got to think about it.
Yes. And I'd say even before that, here's a patient. Are you going to do an epidural on these patients? And I would say, do not. I just reviewed the literature on this once again. Some patients may have short-term benefit. Actually, the ones who have short-term benefit are typically the ones with no disease at all and shouldn't have the epidurals anyway in the first place. There's no long-term benefit. I could not come across any study discussing any long-term benefit. And that could be up to 2 to 3 weeks. Or 6 weeks, but beyond that, not. And think about it. You don't want to do epidural injections and your patient's on aspirin. You can end up with post-op hematomas, intramedullary hematomas, vascular injury, stroke, et cetera. The risks go up and up and up and up without the benefits being there. And unfortunately, a lot of insurance carriers require that patients go for epidurals before they go for surgery. Now, that may be totally inappropriate, especially if the patient has significant disease.
Don't do it is
My
your
answer would be don't do it. Yes.
and you have to tell them, no, I'm not going to do it. It was too risky.
Yeah.
Because people then comply with what the insurance or Medicare wants
That's
because they
right.
don't want the hassle.
Yep.
And
That's.
if you look at the almost the first slide you show, if you go in the cervical space, cervical, if you go in the cervical foramen, you're shot at getting into the subarachnoid space. Or into the epidural space is really limited.
That's right.
I
That's right.
mean, what is your chance? I looked at the picture there and says, what is my chance of getting into that space?
Right.
And I had rather than getting into the cord or something else. I mean, that just isn't,
Well, that's also the transforaminal injections usually done at C71, but they have a much higher morbidity, complication rate, et cetera, than the routine epidurals that are intralaminar or between the lamina. But
Well, if you
no reason to do that.
even if you went to intralaminar,
Still not a good idea.
you got to get into that small space. Not that's not
And
easy.
just think about your patient with very severe cord compression. There is no space.
Right. So again, it's a risk-benefit ratio, and that's what you got to look at. So, do we miss anything?
I don't think so. I think we pretty much covered it. Nasotracheal fibroptic intubations.
Oh yeah.
Don't let your anesthesia. This is the job of the surgeon. You don't just sit in the corner reading your newspaper or on the doctor's lounge. You should be there from the get-go. You should be helping to set up the room. You should be talking to anesthesia. You should be talking to your monitoring people every step of the way. You want them to know what you're looking for. I used to go in and also show the nurses on the OR field, the circulating nurses, the PAs, et cetera, exactly what the pathology was and what the operative plan was going to be. I talked to anesthesia, no hypotension. If this is significant cervical disease, the best way to stroke out the cord is to have a hypotensive event. You're going to lose your monitoring plus everything else. So again, it's compulsive commitment from the get-go, and you're responsible for every step of the way.
I used to make up a list that I'd post on the wall and hand out to the nurses and anesthesiologists, which was the list that you said Joe was, he'd say when he would drive into work, he'd go through the operation in his mind. And it's an outline. I mean, it's just like you're going to take a test. What am I going to do here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Why not let everybody know about it? So,
Right.
anyway. Okay, that's just terrific. I think we've pretty much completed the standard anterior and posterior
Yes.
approaches for the cervical spine. We didn't talk about 360 too much. Why don't we leave that for later? But I
Yeah.
think we pretty much covered that. Okay.
Sounds good to me. Yes.
Okay, Nancy, another terrific job. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Okay, take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes, is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem, or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. At the end of this video, please fill out your rating of this program on the website. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. You can send your questions, comments, or requests for CME credit to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. The foundation which supports these journals supports Surgical Neurology International, which is a 2D Internet Journal. Nancy Epstein is its editor-in-chief. Its web address is sni.global. And the second journal supported is a new journal, SNI Digital Innovations in Learning. It is a live 3D video journal with interactive discussion. Its web address is snidigital.org. All of the contents on these two journals are free 24/7, 365 to everyone everywhere. Surgical Neurology International, SNI, is seen and read in 239 countries and territories and has been published for 14 years. It's the third most widely read 2-day journal in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is viewed in 129 countries in 7 months. It's a new 3D video journal. The foundation is based on the principle of helping people throughout the world. In addition, the foundation has the Medical News Network,
dedicated to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. The information in this program has been copyrighted by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. All rights are reserved. We want to thank you for watching the program. We hope it